Welcome to This Is Your Afterlife, conversations with artists and activists about death and life. I'm Dave Marr. I'm a comedian. I live in Chicago. 9 years ago, I survived a month-long coma, and this is my podcast. Welcome. My guest this episode is Case Blackwell. Case is a comedian. I've known him for a long time, and he is streaming on Twitch. And rather than trying to describe what he does myself, I will just let him describe it in his own words right now.
I guess in case you include this, so it doesn't, people aren't like, what the fuck are they talking about? I'll just explain what the stream is.
Oh, yeah, that's good. I like that.
It's basically, I wanted to do, when I worked for a place called G4, and it went under. But it had a relatively big following on Twitch. So me and a friend were like, let's keep doing Twitch streams, because there's kind of an audience that still wants to see G4-ish stuff. So we did start doing that. But eventually that friend also got busy. We were doing it like together. They got busy and they kind of went off and started doing their own thing. Her name's Fiona. She's great. But I was like, well, I guess I'll keep streaming because I like that there's kind of this audience that'll just tune in to watch you do stuff. I like, you know, I don't perform as much as I did in Chicago and LA. And I think part of me was still missing that kind of improv-y immediate feedback style audience, which Twitch is not a replacement for. But, you know, it's close enough to scratching the itch that I was like, okay, I'll keep going.
Yeah, yeah.
But basically, you know, I felt super uncomfortable just sitting there and reading the news or, like, even just playing a game. It's like, I feel like I have to do something more. I just feel uneasy knowing people are watching me just kind of sip coffee and, like, read articles or sip coffee and, I don't know, play Banjo-Kazooie or whatever the fuck. Even though that's what Twitch is for, so I should have really gotten
on board. Is Banjo-Kazooie still a
no,
current
no, no,
game?
I'd be okay, very okay. Niche at that point.
Yeah.
So first I did a SimCity stream where I was trying to play the mayor. Like, I was performing as the mayor. So, like, I built, like, a big green screen setup where I was behind a desk. But I realized that I was still just sitting there, like, in a weird character, but still just playing SimCity. So I was like, well, maybe there's a way for me to get interviewed like the mayor of a city, you know, in a press conference. And I was like, yeah, but how do I get chat? Because I want to chat to ask questions to the mayor, basically. Yeah, but how do I make it look like there's different people asking the questions? So then I figured out you can use Snap Camera just to, you know, layer some dumb filter on your face. And it doesn't look good, but it gets the idea across, like, the same way like a wig would in an improv set. Like, this is a different person. Then I kind of realized you can do shot reverse shot that way if you have two sources running at the same time. So one shot is permanently you with a Snapchat filter on, and you just reverse that shot. So, it, you know, you like horizontally reverse it. And the other shot's just you. So when you switch between the two, it looks kind of like traditional shot reverse shot. And it's just convincing enough that your brain is kind of like, okay, yeah, I guess that's fine. And then eventually I was like, well, I can't keep playing SimCity. So I just used that same premise to like do like a one-man news team. Where I always have a co-host basically, but the co-host is just me, and to sort of cement the illusion, there's a lot of like B-roll of me just statically looking at the camera so that I can go to wides where I'm like still with the person. It's as dumb as it sounds.
His Twitch stream is very funny. He is a member of Cigarette Sandwich, the sketch group, who produced one of my personal favorite videos of all time, which I've linked in the show notes, September the Calendar Salamander. Also in Cigarette Sandwich are Claire Favorite, Carl Bradley, Bill Stern, who have been guests on the show. Tim Lamphere was a guest in a special episode. Chuck Pettit, Andy Bolduc. I think that's it. I just want to give them all credit. All very funny. And I talked to Case about heavy stuff. We talk about his mom's ALS and both his parents' dementia. So it is heavy, but it is also two comedians talking, and I think you will really enjoy it. If you do enjoy it and you would like to support the show, the best way to do that is on Patreon. You pay $5 or $15 a month to help me keep making the show without ads or corporate backing. If you are paying at the $15 level, you become a Pigeon patron. Those people are G, Barry Fontenot, Shuba Singh, Debo, Fred Fidawa, and Katie Llewellyn. They get shouted out every episode of the podcast. But no matter what level you're at, you get all the bonus content, and there's a lot of good stuff coming. That is all I wanted to say, except if you would like to support Chicago Abortion Fund's Fundathon, that's also in the show notes. And here's my conversation with Case Blackwell. Paint your hell.
Okay, well, there's a couple. There's probably the more realistic version, which is a little more corporeal, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Which, yes. Well, this will come up eventually, so I guess, you know, I can just lay into it. Like basically, my mom had ALS. So it's Lou Gehrig's disease, basically. You know,
right.
It's a kind of muscular dystrophy, but a, you know, some subsect of it that's particularly awful. Basically, eventually you sort of lose bodily function, but like very slowly. We unfortunately had a friend in Chicago who also had it. But anyway, it's a pretty rough disease, unfortunately, because it literally like slowly kind of just takes things away from you that you just take for granted as a person, up to the point of like eventually the reason you die usually is your lungs just no longer function either. Like it removes the ability of your body to like internally do, you know, like non-frontal lobe things. And you kind of, most people die from it by eventually basically drowning in their own lungs, if that makes sense. And that, yeah.
So you'd say that's your hell?
Well, my hell is really
that sounds hellish to you?
That process of like, and here's the thing. The reason this is my hell is I suspect it will happen to me eventually. It's also basically what happened to my dad, just with a different disease. But that you sort of, that I will just be kind of, there's a movie called Diving Bell and the Butterfly. I think it's also about this. It's sort of being locked in your body, and your body's basically become an Iron Maiden that is just torturing you to death. Having observed that happen to two people, that's definitely something that I think I would have to like take the exit ramp there if I knew that that was what I was in for the next like 5 or 6 years, depending on how at what point of it I was in. So I would say that is like my earthly hell, if that makes sense.
Sure.
A more abstract hell. It's really just the idea that like the discomforts of life are what carries over into some eternal recurring consciousness. Like, you know, it's, you don't go to a peaceful place. Yeah, there's physical torture, whatever. I guess you could be somewhere where they're dissecting your penis and filling your mouth with bees every day. That certainly sounds bad, but I think that is just the idea of like permanent discomfort. Whatever the uneases of your life are, that's what you're left with. Those are the things that linger in the air after you die. You know, that time that you said women can't read and your podcast host just stared at you is your eternal hell. While your penis is, of course, getting dissected and they're filling your mouth with bees. And that's probably like the most basic ass version of hell. But I like my general view on the afterlife is a little vague, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it might
like kind of a feeling.
I don't know if it would surprise you to hear that I haven't really interviewed many people who have very definite ideas about the.
Must have gotten a couple that had just been there, right? That just can tell us what's up.
Some of the Colton Burpo "Heaven is for Real" types. Yeah,
can you just have a couple frauds on here, please?
Well, those are the ones who keep getting pitched to me. There's a woman who has been fighting Hitler on a spiritual plane, who wrote a book, and her publicist keeps reaching out to me saying she would be a great fit for the show. And it's getting to the point where as I'm describing this to more people, I'm starting to think it might actually be right.
I mean, but as soon as you said that, I was like, immediate yes. Like, of course, get this person on here. I think that's against your instinct of being honest and kind. You're like, I don't want to have someone on just to sort of ridicule them in the cultural eye. But, I mean, they want to be on, Dave. They have a story to tell.
Okay, well, I'm curious, what is the... And feel free to steer me away. I'm fine doing a silly episode if you don't want to get too heavy. But what is the way to not experience hell in the later stages of ALS as someone who's observed that?
Well, here's the thing with my mom's situation. She had ALS and she had dementia, which so those two things often can like occur together, but it's not a given. Mm-hmm. And she didn't develop dementia immediately. It's a slippery slope. I mean, my dad had dementia too. And that's why I'm like, I'll probably also have it. So the problem is if you lose control of your mind and your body, like what are you fighting back against with?
Right.
So this would get into my general probably view of coping with death. I think the only way to fight against it is to like just accept that there's no fighting against it. Like it is a net negative that is unavoidable and can come at you at any point. And just recognizing that is always a possibility. And I guess as best as you can, just being like, yeah, I'm comfortable that the world might just decide it's over for you and everything's going to be bad now. That maybe if you can make peace with like the you know, reality can sometimes be that vicious. When it happens, it's not like getting thrown into a fire out of nowhere. You're like, hey, okay, yeah, I can see it.
Yeah, I mean, were they? I mean, not to be too bleak, but were they like? Was it just constant misery the last few years?
For my mom, the last year, I would say, unfortunately, yes. Like it's probably the bleakest situation I've observed someone in, which, you know, the misery Olympics. I'm sure there's other things.
Sure, of course.
That are worse. But, you know, she like, she could barely breathe. She couldn't eat. She couldn't speak. She had to be carried or wheeled everywhere. Couldn't control her bowels. If she did breathe, it sounded kind of like, you know, someone struggling to stay alive. Like, you know, like right. Darth Vader style breathing, but without the mask. It was about as bleak as I've been a part of. And, you know, another person that was like the most important to me. So it was.
Right.
It's hard for me to draw a positive out of it. I will say, I think my mom still maintained a little bit of what I'm talking about. She always had a little bit of that, like, it happens kind of attitude.
Okay.
Which I mean, it's crazy to say if it's like you're being tortured by your own body or maybe you've been in some awful situation that someone has put you in, that you're just like, well, sometimes you got to take it on the chin, but like, you know, life's going to force that out of you. Like you're going to eventually have to take something unimaginable probably on the chin. And I think that she kind of had that attitude, did get her through it a little bit. And there were tiny moments of her still getting a kick out of it. Sometimes I could tell she found it kind of funny how bad the situation was.
Really?
Oh, just a little bit. Like, you know, she could barely, like, you can't even control your face. She could, like, barely smile at that point. But, like, there were little signs that there was, like, just a slight sort of devilish sense of humor about the whole thing.
Yeah.
This is a weird story because I don't know if I can tell it without it. May if the person it's about ever hears it, it might make them feel bad, but I hope it wouldn't. Got my girlfriend's in the corner saying, don't. I'll change their name. I'll change their name to Don. She's saying that's not good enough, but it's different. Anyway, this is like the last thing my mom audibly tried to say to me. Because this was at the point where she really couldn't speak. And if she tried to talk, I can't even do it because it would sound like I'm trying to do some kind of offensive bit.
Right.
Anyway, I used to talk to my mom. And even though I knew she couldn't respond, I'd just sort of be in like our living room with her just saying things later in the ALS experience when it had gotten pretty bad. So I was just there. I was like, hey, my friends, you know, I just kind of describe what's going on. I'd be like, yeah, my friend's texting me from Chicago. They want to do some show. Maybe I'll help them with it when I'm back. She had met this friend. So I could tell she wanted to like chime in. So she just started making noises like, eh. And I was like, it's like, hey, I can't understand you, mom. And she also had this thing where you could write with your eyes, but she hated using it. She like resented, I think she was deeply resented the condition she was in. And she didn't even really want to dignify it by using like the implements that still let you interact with the world. So she just kept trying to make noises. Finally, I was like, mom, I love you, but you know, I don't want you to stress yourself out. Like, I just can't understand you. You can use this thing, I understand, if you don't want to, but there's no pressure. She's like, ugh. Like she just makes like a frustrated noise. She finally pulls out this thing she has to use to like write a sentence in 10 minutes or whatever with her eyes. And so she slowly does it. She's not used to it because she never uses it. And she's just like glancing at me the whole time. Like, do you get it yet? I was like, I don't know what this is because it's just coming up one word at a time. It like says my friend's name, Don. And then it says is. And it says G. And I'm like, wait a minute. She just writes, Don is gay. And that's it. This is one of the last things she tried to communicate with me.
And she meant it as like derogatorily.
No, I think she just was like, it'd be funny to call him gay right now. Like a 13-year-old boy would call a 13-year-old boy gay.
It wasn't even
a thing that she would call people. Granted, she also had dementia at this point. But I think she was just like, I think it'd be funny to try to like just tell Case that this guy is gay because it's going to take so much effort. And so she just did this bizarre bit that took like 30 minutes and was emotionally exhausting just to call my friend gay.
Dude, that is like actually fucking inspiring that she got so, that she was so committed to it that she struggled to express it to the point of making the frustration noise and then using this tool that she loathed using, just like, that's very funny.
That's like one of two times she used it, and the other time was to like communicate a medical emergency. I was so blown away when she was using it. I was like, oh no, she's gonna tell me some kind of like final wisdom or something. And it was just to like a fucking 12-year-old on the playground be like, you're gay.
What do you hope happens when you die?
I mean, really, again, it's all very vague for me. I kind of just hope it's peaceful. Honestly, I'd say the most realistic answer is that you just kind of do it again. Like you run it back. I probably like some form of reincarnation the most, but not with any awareness that I've done it before. I like the idea that you just kind of, you just swing at the bat again, but you don't know how to use the bat anymore. You have to relearn it.
Why does that appeal to you, especially not carrying over the consciousness?
I kind of feel like if you manage to make it to some sort of permanent afterlife where your consciousness is carried over, I guess to me, I don't even feel like you maintain like a coherent person from moment to moment in all cases. Like if I met 15-year-old me, it's sort of a stranger. Like I would certainly be a stranger to them. And I mean, the memories I have of myself at 15, I'm like, Jesus Christ, that's like a pretty different
like what?
Little freak. You know, just like the unease and like the dumbass opinions and the things I was worried about, they feel like, or even like when I was 25, like when I was 25 or 23, somewhere in there, 23 to 25, like one of the hugest mental burdens I had was making a Herald team. Like that was deeply important to me. Like, oh my God, what will it mean if I don't get on this? And like, or like when I was, you know, up until even more recently, until I was like 28, I was like, I think I got to get on SNL or like I'm a failure. Like, I guess that's like the crucible for me is I need to get on this one TV show from the 90s that I watched. All of which now to me feel like kind of an alien perspective. Like I know, because I was me, I know where I was coming from, but like, I guess I feel different enough that it doesn't even entirely feel like a coherent person if I just separate the moments out in time in myself. Which is to say, like, I think permanent to me, my hope is that permanence is sort of a reality. Like the person I was when I was 28 is still kind of out there. The person my mom was when she was 28 is still kind of out there. Like the afterlife kind of already happened in a sense, because we're existing in ways that feel impermanent to us, but there's a little bit of permanence to everything, the bad stuff and the good stuff. So that's why to me, like the most interesting afterlife would just be creating more of those moments. Like you just kind of some other cosmic sense of sort of place or some other reality. Maybe you're just a little piece of you gets to do it again.
Well, you're kind of leading me into a question I tend to ask later, but that I feel like pertains to I'm starting to think like, okay, well, are you aware when your consciousness feels new? Like, are you aware when you're like, huh, I think I'm like, my mind is radically changing from when I, you know, 5 years ago or whatever. But the way I ask that question is, what's your coma?
Mm.
Which is just like a moment of transformation where before you're one version of yourself and after you're another. It can be completely mundane. You know, it's just like, I say, what's your coma? Because of who I am. But,
wait a minute. Were you in a coma?
Yeah, dude. So what is your, like, maybe one that has been like on your mind, either whatever first pops into your head when I say that, or something that you're like, man, I'm really like reeling from the fact that when I was, or like for me, there've been times. So I was diagnosed with diabetes at like age 12.
Yeah.
And that's like also a very clear coma moment. But then there have been later times in my life when I'm like, damn, I didn't realize that this happened to me. So it doesn't even have to be a recent thing that happened. It could just be a thing that you are thinking about.
It's hard. I feel like I've had a lot, and many of them are very mundane. Like just a very quick example, and then I'll say the one that probably feels a little more substantial. Remember when I was like 13, I was at a lunch table with a bunch of dudes. And I was like I never exactly had that experience of being like super unpopular and resenting like the cool kids, but there still were like cool kids at my school.
Yeah.
Whose opinion at the time I valued for some reason. And I remember one of them was just talking about like throwing a fork at some kid's head in class and how the teacher hadn't noticed the fork and got mad at the kid or something. It was like a really bizarre story like that. About like harassing the kid, and they're the one who got in trouble, and is kind of gloating about it. And I just had this sense. I mean, it's such an obvious thought, but I was like, oh, I don't have to care what these people think. I don't have to care. I don't have to value the opinions of anyone at my school who considers themselves cool, and they're kind of embarrassing for even feeling that way about themselves. And I, for some reason, the thought at the time like just lifted this weird burden off me of like social anxiety that I just didn't have after that moment. I don't know why I had that thought or why it was successful. It's not that I've avoided like any sense of not fitting in or like, but like the absolute.
You still wanted to join a Herald team after that.
I still wanted to join a Herald team, which is even worse than wanting to impress cool kids in high school. It's probably legitimately worse. But like especially male relationships, I didn't have the same unease that I did, like before that, where I was like really worried about fitting in. And I was afraid to just express my own actual thoughts. It was some kind of like weird imitation game where I was like, what do I say that will like register with these people? I think I eventually kind of had the same moment with women where I stopped treating them like weird foreign objects that I had to, I don't know, like use the right magic spell to get them to want to communicate with me. Eventually, I was like, okay. Oh, wait, they're all. This was when I was unfortunately like 17. I could have learned that lesson at the same time, and I didn't. It's like, oh, I can actually just talk to them like they're also like friends and normal people that don't have some kind of like magical agenda that I don't understand. So, those would be like, I guess, two simpler ones that are maybe just normal for people that are growing up. I think the main example I have is also probably pretty normal because if you live long enough, everybody loses their parents. I do think the experience of losing my mom definitely completely changed how I kind of view the world, but it did not do it like right when she died. It was more so like I went through that experience with her of her having ALS and it getting really bad in like the last 2 years. And then when she died, it was almost like this relief, unfortunately, of like, God, she doesn't have to go through that anymore. But I think it's also unfortunately like a pretty common experience. And something I could even have seen, I kind of saw that coming. I wasn't like, oh my God, I can't believe I feel this way. It was more like, yeah, I guess I do feel this way. Like she's not fucking stuck in that torture machine that her body had become. However, I will say like the going through that and feeling it is fairly numbing. And I don't think it took me quite a while for those feelings to kind of catch up in a way that affected how I viewed the world. Like it took a while to unpack basically the experience. very Joe Rogan style. I hadn't done like hallucinogenics, but I was in Virginia with my brother. He's like, let's do acid. I was like, Jesus Christ. That's not, to the time, at the time, that sounded very extreme to me. And it can be. I'm not encouraging people to do acid. I don't do it all the time. I've done it like a handful of times then and since then. But I will say, I was in the basement with him in this basement we grew up with. We grew up in, like, I grew up in the fucking basement of my parents. We were visiting my dad at the time. We did it really late at night. And I think, like, most hallucinogenics, in my opinion, are kind of like a shortcut to meditation, essentially. The places you can get to by actually probably putting in, like, the healthy version of it.
Right, right.
But I think just the context, being in this place, we'd both gone through this thing. It immediately gave me, like, instant distance on myself, so I could kind of observe. I could observe things it's not even that I wasn't comfortable like looking at them. It was like just things that I couldn't see because I was too in them.
Like what?
It's kind of more, I feel like a lot of my life has been kind of shedding layers of unease to like be a little more comfortable, actually probably being what I would describe as a little closer to who I actually am. And I don't mean that in some altruistic way, like kind of being honest with my actual thoughts and feelings. And I think that night, because again, I do feel like that stuff gives you a little distance on yourself, I just noticed all of these kind of unhealthy walls I'd put up around like a sense of self. Like, I need to appear smart. I need to appear strong. I need to do this and this and that. I need to blah, blah, blah. It was like a bunch of needs that were basically a projection, an attempt to project strength outward. Be like, I'm a cool guy in Chicago who does comedy, and like, and I got it together, and I've got it together for my family, and this and this and that. And I think I felt it finally emotionally, that those things weren't, it's not even that they weren't true, it's that they weren't how I felt. It allowed me essentially to access both a little bit of grief, like I went through this thing with my mom, and my whole family didn't. It's like, we don't even know how to talk about it. So let me talk about it a little bit more. And it also just like, it just calmed down this, like, I guess I would describe it as like a weird masculine energy that I still was kind of holding on to, I guess, because I thought it like protected me a little bit. Like, again, just this idea that like, you're cool. You have a base level of comfort with the world and you're kind of unassailable and like, in this version of yourself that can deal with whatever. And I'm sure that's not how I was coming off to people, but it was a thing I was like actively aspiring to try to do. I just realized that night. And I will say, since then, I don't think you would notice a huge difference just knowing me. You'd be like, yeah, he was the exact fucking same after. But internally, I felt it's like I shed like a huge percentage of the anxiety that I carried around, just kind of melted away. Because it was also just reckoning again with like this idea that you just really can't control, you can't even always control yourself. Like you do kind of have to submit to the universe as it presents itself to you. And you're not going to do yourself any favors by trying to like wear some mask of strength in the face of those things. You are better off like reckoning with them in the way that it's actually feeling to you. And I don't even know if any of that tracks. But the net result was, since then, and I can still feel it today, the anxiety of my 20s was like diminished by a massive amount, to where like I used to desperately want to be on SNL like in my mid 20s. And the sense of like weird failure I had from not doing that for some reason went away. And it didn't even feel like, dude, you lost your fucking hustle and you don't have that. You're like, lost your fucking eye of the tiger. It really felt a little bit more like, God damn, why was that like such a big part of my brain? And it was just gone. And it like felt amazing to have it be gone.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I'm coming from a very specific pinhole of observing you from the outside and only very briefly. Ooh. But I would say getting to know you through Bill and through Cigarette Sandwich guys you seem very different to me than the snap judgments I made of you when.
Well, might be because in my 20s I was dressed like a magician.
That was part of it. Yeah, I was. You're like, who's this guy with the with these shirts and these dress pants? but like, yeah. And I say that with like, who am I to judge clothing and style wise? You know, oh. but when you say like, someone who knew me might not even have noticed. Like the things you're talking about shedding and. The performance of whether it's masculinity or ambition or specific slivers of these things, it seems to me like it reads, not only does what you're saying make sense to me on an intellectual level that could happen to a person, but it reads as having happened to you.
Well, that's interesting to hear. I mean, I certainly feel different than I did in my 20s.
Yeah.
Also, because, I mean, you and I both spent a lot of time pursuing specifically comedic performances of one type or another. I also realized sometime around the death of my mom, which is right when I turned 30. Basically, I turned 30 the next day my mom dies. I'm born June 10th. She dies June 11th.
Jeez.
It made me reevaluate what I was on stage for a little bit. Because, like, I spent my 20s just chasing this idea of doing, like, a good job on stage, which is, it feels a little antithetical to actually communicating anything at this point to me. Like, and I used to teach improv, which is another strike against me. But it was, I could sense that same energy in a lot of the younger performers. It's like they wanted to get a good grade, like, whatever that meant to them, like, a laugh from the audience. It wasn't about internally expressing anything. I mean, it is, ultimately. There's just a lot of stuff in the way of, like, you know, I need to observe the forms. I need this teacher to tell me I'm good. I need my friends to tell me I'm good. And unfortunately, you do kind of need those things. But putting them at like the front of the brain and making that the main pursuit, getting on blank or impressing whoever.
Right, right.
It doesn't, I mean, it'll keep you from getting those things because you can sense those things on stage. It's like thirsty in a way. And it's, you can sense those things just in life. But it just keeps you from actually enjoying it. Cause I still enjoyed performing in my 20s, but looking back, like there just was this chip on my shoulder for some reason of like proving something or appearing as something, that I think like locked me up from exploring a lot of the things that I was actually interested in.
Which are what?
Bugs and, you know, like and dick jokes. It's the exact same jokes, but I just feel better about doing them.
Well, it is. You were like, when you said that, like, I don't even know. You're like, I was obsessed with like being cool or like strong or powerful or whatever. And I have no idea if people even read me that way. It's like, well, if that's the thing you're obsessed with, they almost certainly are not reading you that way. It's like, oh, yeah, that guy Case. It's really awesome how hard he's trying to be cool and strong and powerful, you know?
The thing is, though, I will at least give my 20-year-old self this. It wasn't really for anyone else. It was a performance for myself.
Yeah, yeah. Which came from where? Like, what is it? Was it just cultural, or was there some specific shit that you were like, oh, masculinity becomes really important or something like that?
Yeah, because I don't think I was ever like a bro exactly. I don't think I was ever like,
yeah,
probably what you would think of, if you're thinking like, you know, I was fucking Matt Rifing around the country. mm-hmm. Not exactly. It just was more so of like, so here's like, I used to dress like a magician is a bit that I've said before. I shouldn't keep using that joke.
Hey, dude, we're almost 10 years on from my coma, so I haven't let that go. I think you're good.
But honestly, that was partially because all of those were clothes my mom gifted me. My mom used to, my mom used to just send me clothes when I lived in Chicago. Cause I think it was a way for her to feel like she still had a bigger hand in my life. Cause she was worried about me. So she's like, I'll send him cool clothes. And you know, they were looking back, I'm like, whew, those were some clothes for sure. Like I used to have boots with like dragons running all the way up them. I would just wear them. And anyway,
Which, like, now, like, you can imagine, like, rocking those in a cool way if you, like, knew how to, like, style them.
If I'd been in L.A. in 25 and just dialed it in a little bit more, it could have been a whole thing, maybe. Yeah. And I'd still be wearing them. And I'd be like, you don't understand. This is who I am.
Yeah.
But, you know, it really, the reason I was wearing them is I knew a lot of people were like, why the fuck is he wearing that? And I was like, fuck you. Fuck you. I'm going to wear these. Even though, like, I didn't particularly like them. I guess I could be generous and say, like, you know, it made me feel a little connected to my mom. And, like, it felt kind of, to me, it felt a little sweet. But I was like, really, the answer was to a lot of the airs I was putting on. I was like, yeah, I am. What do you want to do about it? It's, like, extremely childish. Like, well, it was a sense of, like, superiority, I think, in a way. Like, yeah, I'm going to wear these. I am going to do this. And I mean, that maybe a little of that energy can be healthy if you're dealing with, like, very judgmental people, which in comedy you are.
Yeah.
But I think it was internally unhealthy, and it wasn't even a thing that was for me. So I don't know. It's another version of a thing that I'm kind of happy, that, a feeling that I've left behind.
Well, it feels like the training wheels version of the lunch table thing that you're talking about, where it's like one way of not caring about what people think is of very aggressively flaunting what they think, which is still a way of caring about what they think, but it might kind of give you the launch pad to genuine self-expression at some point.
Yeah. And anyway, it's not like I have, like, genuine self-expression now. I don't know. I still don't entirely know what that is. Again, most of my register here is just, like, how much anxiety I'm carrying around at a base level. It feels like I'm losing levels of those as I age, at least for now, until it gets worse.
Yeah,
because I get
some horrible disease. Come on. You don't really think you have genuine self-expression now, or you just, like, feel the need to self-deprecate as a comedy
person? It's just that I don't know what the I guess I don't know what metric you would live up to where you can be like, and now I'm doing it. There's definitely moments, even in life, just where I'm like, yeah, I felt like I accessed some part of myself that felt more honest. But you know, it's like a moving target.
I want to ask you to relive one memory, because the one-man show that the podcast grew out of was based in the afterlife, and one of the features of that afterlife was you get to fully relive one memory as, like, a room you can pop into and out of whenever you want. It's particularly vivid. Mm. It doesn't sacrifice the rest of your memories. It's just one given pride of place above the others. And if that were the case, what memory would you choose?
I don't know. There's, like, the very, like, revelatory ones where I feel like I've accomplished something, I guess, are kind of satisfying, but I almost feel like I need the context of everything that came before them for it to feel like an achievement. It's like, you know, if you ever watched an anime when they beat the big bad at the end, there's, like, the splash shot of your hero being like, "Date bio, I fucking did it." That's technically, like, the payoff, but, you know, you got to read 100 chapters before it if you want to cry when Naruto beats the guy.
Sure.
So I don't know, like I've had shows or some and stuff where, like, the audience seemed really into it afterwards, where, like, that feeling was very satisfying, but I don't know if even just having that night would actually make it feel that satisfying. There's also, like, romantic stuff that have certainly been, like, highlights. But I will say, like, if it was something I just had to relive again and again, this is such a fucking
don't judge it
memory. I remember when I was 16, and again, there's really nothing to this. I was just driving home, just drinking a Yoo-hoo, a fucking chocolate milk processed ass, not even milk, just sugar and brown water, with light chocolate syrup flavoring. Anyway, I hated swim practices. I swam until I was about 16. The problem was I was pretty good at it, but I did not enjoy it at all. So, like, I hated going to practice. I always wanted a way up. And at that point I was, like, also pretty burnt out with school. Like, I was in my full on, like, I'm in prison 8 hours a day and I hate it era. And, But it was a half day, so like we got out around noon. I went to swim practice and then I got out around 2. And I was like exhausted from the practice because they're always a lot. They're like 2 hours of just fucking staring at a concrete floor and swimming as hard as you can. And there was just something, it was like just the right time in spring where it was like, it was really nice. So it wasn't too hot, wasn't too humid yet. My window's down. I just got in a car, which I'm sure also provided a great sense of freedom to 16-year-old Case. And I was nice and spoiled. I literally just got a car at 16. And there's just something about driving home, drinking this fucking sugar drink, and just the way like the road I was on looked. It was like empty, but not in an apocalyptic way. Like, I wasn't like, oh my God, there's no one around. It was like I knew people around, but the stretch I was on was like very clear. And it was the whole landscape around me was just very nicely saturated. It was like spring in Virginia. It was like flowers and greens and everything. For some reason, I just felt like at ease at a level that up to that point in my life, I hadn't. And I don't know why it came out there. I was just driving home. It was like how tired I was suddenly felt really nice. And it felt good to be like leaving a place and just going somewhere else. Just the sense of movement felt really nice. It felt tactile in a way that I was like, what the fuck is this? For lack of a better term, for some reason, it felt like a moment of like spiritual peace that I just hadn't had. And it was just driving. So something about that also made it feel nice. There was nothing to it. It was so mundane. I guess if I could go back, I would, if I could somehow feel that exact sense, that would be a very nice thing to tap into. But I don't know what made me feel it. And I don't know. I like, it's not a thing I know how to access, unfortunately, just at will. I had a couple other moments sort of like that, but for some reason that one, 16 in my fucking car drinking Yoo-Hoo. I still can like half remember that. And every time I half remember it, I'm like, God damn, that felt very satisfying.
Well, it's two things. It's interesting to me that it is an experience of, you didn't say peace, you said ease. And that's a thing we've basically been talking about in negative this whole time, is the lack of ease that you felt at various moments and the sort of like trajectory you've traced of like, more and more ease. Is that wrong of me to say?
Certainly internally. A little more ease towards myself, at least.
Yeah.
But don't and get twisted. I'm like been on my grind like 24/7.
Oh, for sure. You're doing your best to create second screen content absolutely. As much as possible.
Yeah.
But the other thing is that the thing I don't tend to say to people is that the way that shows up in that show is there's the audience interactive portion where I ask the audience to tell me a memory. And then I like try to, with the whole audience, like give that person a recreation of that memory. Mm. But it comes from me performing my actual answer to that question, which is strikingly similar to what you just described.
Really? Interesting.
My answer that like gave birth to the question, because I had the answer first, was in a car, was driving in Cincinnati, where my parents live, not in high school. It was like I was back. And it was consuming not a Yoo-Hoo, but a turkey sandwich that I had made for myself. Yeah. And there was music. Is that like the music was like a big key part of it. But it was by myself, and it was like just there was a purity to mine was a little bit more like silliness and joy, because I was like rapping along to this song with this like turkey sandwich in my mouth, and I realized how like ridiculous it felt. Mm-hmm. But there is something about driving by yourself in like relatively well manicured suburban space. Mm-hmm. That's like, man, dude, the suburbs can be so oppressive.
Yeah.
But those brief glimpses you get of like, ooh, this is like a real strong hit of suburbs that is like mm-hmm. getting me high right now is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, for me, it was part of that sense of like, It was like a semi-suburban area. It's like woods dotted with houses was kind of this road I would take home. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it was like a little bit of sense of life around you. And then also just like a lot of nature around you.
Yeah.
So feeling, but I'd say if I had to describe it, really simplify it down, it just felt a little untethered. It felt like the concerns I had behind me and in front of me were kind of just gone. And I was just like, you know, I guess maybe is Taoist the right word? Like I was just a guy driving a car, drinking a Yoo-hoo, and that felt very satisfying.
Yeah, I think that's the word 99% of people would use if you said a guy driving a car, drinking a Yoo-hoo. Most people go like, oh yeah, that's Taoism.
yeah, I think I covered it.
Okay, did that sarcasm work? Did I? I think I hit it there. Okay.
Yeah. Well, it would have been better if you before that were like, about to say something sarcastic.
Yeah. It is ironic,
though. Dumb you are, Case.
it's not sarcasm, like because sarcasm is such a like dirty word, you know. It is like it is irony, not sarcasm. Yes. That's more fun.
Why do I think it's? Oh, I think it's that old thing of like the monk being like he eats his food and then he asks like the enlightened monk what they do and they're like clean your bowl. It's just like, and apparently I'm not doing that. Whatever, I'm not doing that story justice.
The before I chose to go into the irony, I knew exactly what you were talking about. I know very much exactly the sort of way in which that is Taoist. I just chose to
be
ironic about it.
I'm just saying it is a dumb guy version of it, like a kid drinking a Yoo-hoo driving. But I guess the feeling is probably somewhat in the things I've read about that particular way of looking at the world.
Well, it only feels silly because it's got like pop culture attached to it. So it's not like, you know, it's a car and it's a Yoo-hoo as opposed to like a horse and a jug of water. And immediately it would feel like a Cohen.
It is also like the most suburban shit ever. Like I'm driving home from swim practice because I got out of school early and I'm drinking a Yoo-hoo.
Yeah.
But this is why I know, like, you can't control the moments that matter because that moment is still vividly in my brain. And it makes me sound like the most basic bitch on the planet. And I can't deny it.
I know the feeling. Did you in that moment have a sense that it would stick with you?
Yeah. Well, no, afterwards. I was like, okay. What the fuck was that? And I was like, oh, shit, I remember it incredibly vividly. It happened 2 seconds ago, and then it stayed with me.
Yeah.
It's not like something I think about constantly, but no, totally. I'm like, why did that? You ever play the game Earthbound?
No. What is it?
So Earthbound's like an old NES game. SNES. But anyway, you just have to walk around collecting. It's a crazy game where it's very abstract. But the thing you have to do to beat the final boss is you go collect like these moments.
Okay.
Where they're just like, it's like, I can't remember the name of it, but you go to a place and you'll like walk into a pond and then it'll like play a little noise and you're like, that's collected like a memory or something. Anyway, that's how it felt to me. As a 16-year-old, I was like, holy shit, I just had an Earthbound. because in that game, I was like, why is he walking around collecting like pond memories or whatever? And I was like, oh my God, it's got a pond memory.
You had actually had the experience of playing Earthbound before that, and you did. Yes,
that is literally the terms I thought of it in at 16.
That is the show. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Case for coming on. Check out his Twitch stream. It's fucking weird and great. Also, thank you to Lake Mary, the This Is Your Afterlife house band, as well as a ongoing musical concern all its own. For all the music in this episode, go to Patreon to support the show. Another way to support the show with your words, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, write a review there. It makes me feel good, and it makes people who are looking for podcasts to listen to trust that this is a good one. And until next week, remember, you are a mist.